of why they're behaving cranky. They're not behaving cranky just because they can. One element that you said is maybe they're not getting enough sleep. Another element is that maybe their nutrition is not well. They're not eating nutritious food. What other physical needs may they be that parents have to be on the lookout for?
Sometimes you find that children are just not healthy physically, right? They're just physically on the weaker side. So this can be due to many reasons. It can be a very temporary thing where the child's got a stomach bug, or it's got a bit of fever, or something's hurting. Then these are temporary things that with a quick cure, with natural remedies or just time, sometimes children get better and back to normal, basically. Sometimes you realize that actually it's a bit more deeper than that. It can be related to a physical illness, basically, that's making the child weaker in their body. So sometimes it can be vitamin D deficiency, it can be low red blood cells, and this can be it can be a tummy bug that's on a long-term tummy bug, parasites and these kind of things which are bothering a child, basically. They're not necessarily showing any signs of being ill at the moment. It's not like they're in bed or anything, but inside their body they're not very strong, they're not very the body's not working very well. And so parents need to get these things checked as well. Sometimes it requires a blood test, it requires a stool test, just to make sure that a child is keeping healthy physically. And you realize that sometimes because of these illnesses, a child can be very much unhappy, very much cranky all day long, because they're just being weak in their body and their body is not coping physically. So that's something to take care of and ensure that this physical need has been met.
Okay, so moving on from the physical need, which we can also have a physician assess. What about tapping into the mind of our child and trying to find the root there? What's happening there? Maybe they're physically okay, or there's nothing serious. How can we find the root of their problem according to themselves?
So that goes back to the emotional needs. So emotional needs, we talked about, children need a lot of love from parents. And you realize, I don't want to give any numbers, but a very high rates of children that are cranky is because they're seeking attention, right? And seeking attention equals I'm not feeling that I'm loved, right? And we said that a primary need of a child is to feel that they're loved, that their parents love them a lot. Okay, my mom loves me a lot, my dad loves me a lot. This need of love is very, very crucial. And we mentioned this in many times in the riwayat and the hadith that we have from the Prophet and from the Ahlul Bayt, about the importance of parents not just loving their children, but showing this love to them and showing this affection to their children. And parents who don't do this, parents are busy at work, when they're home, they're on the phone, or mom's cooking, or dad's got a meeting, or just simply, my mind's just full. Because my mind's full, even when I'm home, I don't give enough attention to my child. I don't say, I love you. I don't give them a hug. I don't show appreciation for them. What happens that this builds on and it leads to a lack in the child in terms of this affection. And this leads to a child looking for ways to seek attention, right? It's like an alarm bell saying that I'm here and I want some love, basically. And so parents need to therefore ensure that they give enough love to cover that need.
Okay, in regards to that, some of the grandparents oppose that kind of behavior. They say that our current generation is too much involved with showing love, showing empathy and all of that. Whereas in our generation, parents didn't tell us, I love you. They didn't treat us specially. And there was no such problem like cranky children. As a matter of fact, parents were very strict, very tough. And children grew up to be men if they're boys, or ladylike if they're girls. How would you address this topic?
Okay, so there's a few points over here. I'm not sure if we'll manage to address the entire question, but we can give it a start. So first and foremost, when we talk about showing affection, showing love, obviously there's a limit to it, right? We're not talking about spoiling a child, right? We're talking about answering a need of the child, is to feel this affection from the child, from the parents. And this is very important. So let's clear any doubts that you may have. We're not talking about spoiling a child or making a child very weak because of showing extreme amount of love and affection to the extent that this becomes abnormal or not very natural, basically. No, we're talking about showing love in a very natural way, in a very normal way, to the extent that a child feels that I'm loved by my parents, and this is extremely important.
All right, thank you very much. The child feels secure, basically. That's what we're looking for.
Exactly.
Let's take a break, and after the break, we'll be back for further discussions.
Musnad ibn Hanbal, narrating from Walid ibn Uqba, who said, "When the Prophet of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, conquered Mecca, the people of Mecca came to him with their children, and he patted them over their heads and prayed for them."
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Brother Mighdad, and we're talking about children who are cranky and they cry a lot. So we talked about physical needs, addressing their physical needs. A physician might need to see them. We need to check their sleep and their nutrition. We talked about the mental needs, which is love. And the question that we had just before the break was that some people think that our generation is giving too much love and children are growing attached and weak. And you explained that we don't want to give too much love. We want them just to feel secure. Would you like to explain more about that?
So yes, we mentioned before the break that when we talk about showing love, we're talking about showing love in a balanced and very normal way, basically. And you realize that it's true, perhaps you may say that in the older generation, parents were very strict and we all turned out fine. So first and foremost, we didn't all turn out fine, okay? There is a kind of weakness within people, a lack of even self-confidence at times, that is due to a very weak relationship between parents and children. If you realize that the next generation were very quick to abandon their parents, were very quick to look for somewhere else for love and affection, right? The reason why is because, remember, love is that which builds relationship, right? If parents didn't show enough love to their children, the relationship between parents and children is also very weak. And this we've seen in the new generation, that this has weakened so much that parents end up in homes, children are looking for attention and affection in other things other than the family. We've seen that the new generation's ability to hold on to a family is also very weak. Their ability to interact with their family members is very weak. It has impact. We can't just make a blunt statement and say, no, we all turned out fine whilst our parents were very strict. So I don't like generalization, for sure. What we know is that we've been told in our hadith from the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt that it's very important that we give and show love. So in many sessions ago, we talked about the different ways that the Prophet have taught us, whether when they would pick up children and kiss them, when the Prophet would, for example, put his hand on a boy's head, for example, or he would play with them. Just all of this shows that it was extremely important for them, for children to be shown love to. And the impact of it, the result of this, is a need being fulfilled. And once this need is fulfilled, then there's a huge amount of benefits and growth that happens through that. One of them is, to answer the question, is avoids having cranky children.
All right, thank you very much. That's all the time we have. I think we're still going to be talking about this on our next episode, so don't miss that one. And if you missed this episode, don't worry, you can always download an archive from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, that's parstoday.com, find our page Call of Islam, and you can download all our episodes from there. Also, you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir, that's englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget, everything that you hear isn't just about your children, it's also about the children of your community, who are the future of your society. Until next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Lecture.
Sheikh Tahir Reza Jaffer.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
We are continuing our discussion on Al-Khutbah Al-Qasi'ah, Khutbah, which is the longest in Nahjul Balagha, and in the version that has been translated, it is Khutbah number 192. In this khutbah, so far we have seen that Amirul Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, he has told us about how Shaytan is our enemy and how he makes us arrogant. And he has told us about the problems of arrogance and the disease of arrogance and what happens if we become arrogant. In this part of the khutbah, the Imam alayhi salam begins by advising us to look at history and see what happened to those nations who were in the past who were arrogant. What was the result of their arrogance? And the Imam alayhi salam, in the beginning, he talks about three types of ways in which we should interact with the history of these people. Number one, he says, he uses the phrase fa'tabiru. Fa'tabiru means take ibrah, take lesson. He says fa'tabiru bima asaba al-umam al-mustakbirina min qablikum. Take a lesson with what happened to those nations who are proud before your time. What happened to them? Learn from that. The second thing he mentions with regards to the history, he says, he uses the phrase wat-ta'idhu. Wat-ta'idhu means take maw'idha, take admonition. Now that you have taken a lesson, take admonition also. See what happened to these people in the past. وَاتَّعِذُوا بِمَثَاوِي خُدُودِهِمْ وَمَصَارِعِي جُنُوبِهِمْ. Take maw'idha, take admonition from what? From the places where those people who are arrogant lay in the earth. Mathawi khududihim is very beautiful, the eloquence of Amirul Mu'mineen. It cannot be conveyed, I cannot do justice in the translation. Khudud means the cheeks. Mathawi khududihim, the place where their cheeks are resting on the ground in their graves. وَمَصَارِعْ جُنُوبِهِمْ, and the place where their bodies lay. That is what you have to take admonition from when you're looking at history. And the third thing he says is وَاسْتَعِيذُ. Now that you have taken lesson, number one. Number two, you have taken admonition. Now number three, وَاسْتَعِيذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنْ لَوَاقِحِ الْكِبْرِ. Now seek refuge from Allah from arrogance. You have seen what happened to those who came before you who are arrogant. Now seek protection from Allah from this arrogance. كَمَا تَسْتَعِيذُونَهُ مِنْ طَوَارِقِ الدَّهْرِ. The same way you seek protection from Allah from natural disasters and catastrophes, that same way you should seek refuge with Allah from kibr and from arrogance. Number two, he says, if Allah were to allow any of His servants to be proud, He would have allowed His prophets and His awliya. وَلَكِنَّهُ كَرَّهَ إِلَيْهِمُ التَّكَابُرُ. However, Allah Azza wa Jal detests for them and has made detestable to them pride and arrogance. وَرَضِيَ لَهُمُ التَّوَابُعُ. And He has preferred for them humility. So that's point number two in the summary. Point number three in the summary of this part of the khutbah is that the Imam says that Allah Azza wa Jal gives a lot of hardships and tests the Anbiya and the Awliya with a lot of difficulty. And point number four, the Imam says, never take wealth and children to be the gauge of your closeness to Allah Azza wa Jal. These are the four points that summarize this part of the khutbah. So now we want to look at them in detail, and we derive three themes from this. Theme number one is regarding history. The Imam says, go back and look at history. Look at those people who are proud. What happened to them? The importance of history is very important. We know, every one of us knows that history is important. And we have works written by great scholars about the importance of history. For example, Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr has an interesting book known as Trends of History in the Quran. A book worth reading. And so, what are the benefits? There are five benefits we can talk about when it comes to using history to teach. When Allah uses history to teach us, why is that the case? Number one, when you use history as examples, you clarify things that may be difficult. When you give a theory which is a bit difficult for people to understand, if you want to make it easy for them to understand, use examples. And when you use historical examples, then it becomes easy for people to understand. Number one. Number two, when you make a claim, you're teaching something, you make a claim, if you bring an example, you substantiate your claim. You give credibility to your theory. So giving an example from history, now you give an instance of what you are saying, which means now you are giving an example to substantiate your claim. That's number two. Number three, when you use history while teaching the people about something, you remove the monotony. If a person were to teach only theory, the class would get bored very quickly. But once you start bringing history, then now people start finding it interesting. That is number three, you remove the monotony. Number four, when you use history to teach, then that lesson remains in the mind of your listeners and your students for longer. It remains in the memory. Why? Because it's a story. People love stories. History is a story. A true story. But a story nonetheless. So people, their imaginations are enlivened and evoked. And therefore it remains in their memory for longer. And the fifth benefit of using history is, when you teach history with history, you know that history repeats itself. So by learning history, you can plan for the future. You can plan for your future. If you see that you are in a certain situation, somebody in the past was in that situation, what happened to them? What did they do to resolve the problem? And so when you learn this, you can also use and benefit from this. These are the benefits of history. Now, can you give us one example? Yes. A question that is sometimes asked by our young brothers. They say that we live in an era where our imam is in ghaiba. The imam of our time is in occultation, is in ghaiba. How can I establish a bond of love and intimacy with an imam whom I have never met? Question. The young people ask, how can I establish a bond of love for an imam I have never met? So we go back in history. Has there been any such case? That how has it happened? Has it happened? Can you say yes, it has? What is your evidence from history? We say yes. There were some people at the time of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi who became Muslims but never met the Prophet. They are known as Mukhadram. A Sahabi is one who meets the Prophet. He's a Muslim and meets the Prophet, is Sahabi. But if he is a Muslim and he has never met the Prophet, he's called Mukhadram. One example, very famous, is of Uwais al-Qarni. Uwais al-Qarni never met the Prophet. He was a Muslim. He accepted Islam. He never met the Prophet. But he had such a deep love for the Prophet in his heart that he always wished that he could come and meet the Prophet. Without meeting the Prophet, he had that love in his heart. He wanted to meet the Prophet. He could not travel from Yemen where he stayed. He was one, very poor. And two, he had an elderly mother whom he was taking care of. So he could not leave. One day he manages to convince his old mother, please allow me to go and meet the Holy Prophet. And his mother says, I will allow you in one condition, that you go, you meet him and come back. You are not allowed to stay there, not even for a single day. And so Uwais is overjoyed, he's happy, finally he got permission. He comes all the way to Medina. At that time Rasulullah is not in Medina, he has traveled. And so he could not stay. With tears in his eyes, he goes back to Yemen. When the Prophet comes to Medina, he says, I smell the fragrance of Uwais. Uwais. So how do you establish that bond of intimacy with an imam that you have never met? How did Uwais do it? You take an instance from history. You see, it is possible. It has been done. And so this is how history benefits. Now, the imam in this khutbah is saying, now look at the history of the proud people and see what happened to them. Look at the history of the mustakbireen, of the arrogant ones, what happened to them. And learn from that history. We look at two instances. One from the time of Nabiullah Ibrahim alayhi salam. You know that Ibrahim alayhi salam was convincing people to believe in Allah Azza wa Jal, but the people were arrogant. They did not want to believe. Many of them did not believe. And the ruler at that time was Namrud. Namrud was very arrogant. He did not want to believe in God. And the Quran describes beautifully the argument that took place between Namrud and Ibrahim alayhi salam. Ibrahim alayhi salam is brought in front of Namrud. And Namrud says, who is this God you are talking about? Tell me, what is so special about him? Ibrahim alayhi salam replies, قَالَ رَبِّيَ الَّذِي يُحْيِي وَيُمِيتِ. My Lord, my God is the one who gives life and causes death. Namrud thought for a moment and he said, أَنَا أُحْيِي وَيُمِيتِ. Even I give life and cause death. He brought two prisoners from his prison. One of them, he said, behead him. The other one, he said, you are free to go. He said, look, I gave that one death. I gave that one life. أَنَا أُحْيِي وَأُمِيتُ. I also do that. So Ibrahim alayhi salam said that my Lord, يَأْتِ بِالشَّمْسِ مِنَ الْمَشْرِقِ, brings the sun out from the east. فَأْتِ بِهَا مِنَ الْمَغْرِبِ. So you bring it from the west. My Lord brings the sun out from the east, you bring it out from the west. If you are comparing yourself to Allah Azza wa Jal, فَبُهِتَ الَّذِي كَفَرُ. And then he could not respond. And that is how he was defeated in the argument. But Namrud did not believe. Namrud stuck to his arrogance. And the riwayat tell us how Namrud was punished for this. We are told that a small insect like a mosquito was sent. It entered his nostrils and went into his brain, into his head, the riwayat says. And it caused so much pain that he would hit his head on the wall just to relieve himself of that pain. Until in the end he died. The punishment of Allah Azza wa Jal on the arrogant ones, the proud ones. This is one example. Another example again from the Quran is the famous story of Qarun and Musa alayhi salam. We know Qarun was very boastful. When, because Qarun before, he was a pious man. He was one of the relatives of Musa alayhi salam. We are told he was a cousin of Prophet Musa alayhi salam. He was a pious man. He had a very beautiful voice. He would recite Tawrat in a very beautiful voice, we are told. Qarun. And then Allah Azza wa Jal gave him wealth. And he became so wealthy that we are told that just to carry the keys of his treasure, it would take so many strong men just to come and carry the keys, not the treasure, the keys of his treasure. Qarun. And so he would come out boastfully amongst the people. The riwayat tell us he would come out with a retinue of 4,000 horsemen. And 3,000 slaves. Wherever he went, he was accompanied by 4,000 horsemen, 3,000 slaves. Boastfully, with very luxurious clothing and different kinds of pompous behavior, that he is very wealthy. That is how he would come out. And when the righteous people, including Musa alayhi salam, would go and warn him that, what are you doing? This is not right. In fact, Allah has blessed you with this wealth. You should now help the poor. You should do infaq. He would say, إِنَّمَا أُوتِيتُهُ عَلَىٰ عِلْمٍ عِنْدِي. I got this wealth by my own ilm, by my own knowledge. So he thought it was his own doing. He was arrogant. He was proud. And Musa alayhi salam would always advise him and he would always rebuke him for his behavior. Until one time Qarun got so upset. He said, I have to do something about this. So he decided to pay a fahisha, a lady of ill repute. And he told that lady that when Musa alayhi salam is addressing an august gathering where there are so many people, I want you to stand up. And I want you to blame him and accuse him of having illicit relations with you. Qarun pays this lady. And so Musa alayhi salam, one day he is addressing a large gathering. And the lady stands up. Now there are different versions of the story. One version says that before she could open her mouth, she felt guilt. Another version says, no, she actually accused the Prophet, Prophet Musa alayhi salam. And Prophet Musa told her, swear by the Tawrat. But when the Tawrat was brought before her, she felt guilty. In the end, she ended up saying that it was Qarun who paid me to say this. Musa alayhi salam is innocent. But this hurt Musa alayhi salam so much that he prayed to Allah Azza wa Jal and he cursed Qarun. And what was the result? فَخَسَفْنَا بِهِ وَبِدَارِهِ الْأَرْضِ. Allah Azza wa Jal punished Qarun such that he and his wealth were swallowed up by the earth. The result of arrogance. This is another example of the result of arrogance. So when we look at history, we find indeed arrogance is something that when it comes, the result is always negative. And even when we look at the empires, the great empires, the Roman Empire, the Mongol Empire, all these empires, you find at the end of the day, they are all in the dust. No matter how arrogant, how great they were, now they are in the dust. And that is why Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. He tells us, seek refuge with Allah from pride the same way you seek refuge from natural disasters. Pride is so bad, and this is the result of pride. So that is the first theme. The theme of looking at history and seeing what happened to the proud people in the past. The second theme relates to the qualities of the Anbiya and the Awliya alayhim salam, because we find that indeed, when it comes to the Anbiya and the Awliya, they are the best of people. Now, when we're talking about Anbiya and Awliya, we saw that we were told that there are four kinds of hardships that they face. Number one is known as makhmasa. Makhmasa in Arabic means intense hunger. So much does a person get hungry in makhmasa that his stomach goes inside and is constricted. The Anbiya of the Prophets are tested with makhmasa, are tried with makhmasa. That is one of the hardships they have to face. And indeed, when we look at the history, we find this is true. When we look at the history of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, when in Sha'be Abu Talib, in that valley of Abu Talib, where they were under boycott, the Muslims were under boycott, what happened? There was scarcity of food to such an extent that the Prophet's stomach went in, got constricted. And history tells us that he would tie a stone on his stomach out of hunger. This is known as makhmasa. So Imam Ali alayhi salam tells us that one of the trials that the Prophets of Allah azza wa jal faced was makhmasa. The second type of trial that the Prophets of Allah faced was known as majhada. Majhada means mashakka, hardship, difficulty. Like what happened to Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam inside the prison. He had to face prison. This was mashakka, hardship. The third kind of hardship that prophets face is makhawif. Makhawif means fear. Some of the prophets of Allah azza wa jal had to face fear. Like Musa alayhi salam, when he ran from Misr and went to Madian, he was afraid. He had to run away from Misr to Madian. So sometimes the prophets face makhawim. And the fourth thing is makareh. The words that Imam uses here are very interesting. He says, wa makhatahum bil makareh. Makhata in Arabic means to shake violently. And the etymology of makhada comes from when you take yogurt, and in the olden days, this is what they used to do. They would take yogurt and they would put it in a leather bag. And they would shake that leather bag violently for a long time in order to turn that yogurt into butter. To turn the yogurt into butter, that shaking would be done. It had to be a very severe kind of shaking. That is known as makhada. So Imam says, مَخَضَهُمْ بِالْمَكَارِ. He would shake his prophets violently with difficulties. So the Prophet of Allah Azza wa Jal faced all kinds of difficulties. So now when we look and we want examples from history, we find so many examples from the lives of the Prophets of Allah Azza wa Jal, Prophet Ayyub alayhi salam. We all know his story, how many difficulties he faced until today. Now, when you see somebody who is very patient, you always say Sabr Ayyub. He has Sabr Ayyub. He's the embodiment, because he faced so many difficulties. But the difficulties he faced were personal difficulties. The difficulties he faced were not related to his prophetic mission, were related to himself. But Prophet Nuh alayhi salam faced difficulties in relation to his tabligh. He did tabligh for 900 years and he propagated the message of Allah Azza wa Jal for 900 years. And it was very difficult. And if you read Surah Nuh alayhi salam, you see how Prophet Nuh alayhi salam complains to Allah Azza wa Jal. He says, I call them day and night. فَلَمْ يَزِدُهُمْ دُعَاءِ إِلَّا فِرَارًا. Whenever I call them, they would just run away. They would keep their fingers in their ears. They would cover themselves. They would run away. They would threaten to stone me. They would threaten to kill me. Oh Allah Azza wa Jal, I have tried. I have done everything. The difficulties he faced in tabligh. But there is no prophet who has faced more difficulties than our beloved Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Why is it, Ya Rasulullah, we have seen other prophets suffering so much. Why is it that your suffering is more? Because not only the enemies of Rasulullah would disturb him, even his followers would disturb him. Not only during his lifetime, but even after his death. We know that the enemies of Rasulullah, when he prayed, they would throw dirt on him, they would call him names, they would say he's a magician, he's a sorcerer, he's a liar. These are the enemies. But even the followers and the companions in Hudaybiyah, they began questioning the authority of Rasulullah. He told Fatimatu Zahra, salawatullahi wa salamu alayha, of what would happen to her, and he told her that you will be the first person to join me. When Aba Abdullah al-Husayn salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, when he was born, the Prophet wept. That means the Prophet knew what was going to happen after he left this world. So the Prophet was the one who suffered the most. But suffering is part and parcel of those who follow the haqq. If you are a person who follows haqq, be ready for suffering. That is why in the Quran we are told, وَتَوَاصَوْا بِالْحَقِّ وَتَوَاصَوْا بِالصَّبْرِ. They tell each other and advise each other to espouse the haqq, to hold on to the haqq, but then also to have sabr. Why? Because when you have haqq, you need sabr. One of the kinds of sabr out of the three is sabr fil ibadah, being patient in worship. In this part of the sermon, the Imam says that the prophets were so humble that they would put their face down in sujood on the dust. They were worshippers of Allah Azza wa Jal. The Holy Prophet would worship Allah so much that the ayah was revealed, Taha, ma anzalna alayka al-Qur'an litashqa. He used to stand until his feet were swollen. Allah said, take it a little easy, O Prophet. Don't worry. Don't overburden yourself. Imam Sajjad, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, he used to pray so much that his knees were swollen and he would have a mark on his forehead. He was known as Dhuthafinat because of his ibadah, kathratul ibadah. It's so important to realize the importance of ibadah. Unfortunately, today we have taken ibadah to be a ritual. We don't understand the value of ibadah, the importance of ibadah. It's a ritual. And that is why Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, he said, a time will come when nothing of the Quran will remain except the letters on the page. Nothing of Islam will remain except the name. When that time comes, you will see beautiful mosques, but empty of hidayah. No hidayah in these mosques. And so humility is there in prophets and in awliya. One example of humility, and I will end your zahma inshaAllah. Sahib al-Jawahir, a very important alim, his name was Shaykh Muhammad Hassan al-Najafi. When he was on his deathbed in Najaf, he told his people to invite all the top tier ulama, all the elite amongst the ulama, so that he could appoint a successor after him. Who would be the marja taqleed after him? And so they call all the ulama except one alim. whose name was Sheikh Murtada al-Ansari. When he is on his deathbed and they have called all the ulama, he asked the people, where is Sheikh al-Ansari? He says, we did not find him. Please look for him. And so they go and they look for him and they find him in the haram of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam doing dua for Sahib al-Jawahir. He was in the haram. He was praying for the shifa of Sahib al-Jawahir. And so they say to him, please, we want to invite you to the house of Sahib al-Jawahir. There's an important meeting. And when Sheikh Murtada al-Ansari is brought there, Sahib al-Jawahir is so pleased. He calls him nearby. He takes his hand and he places it on his chest and he says, now I feel that I am ready to leave this world. And he tells all the top tier ulama who had gathered there that Hada marja'ukum min ba'di. This is your marja after me. And he leaves this world. What does Sheikh al-Ansari do? Sheikh al-Ansari is very worried. He does not want to take this post, this position. The ulama are so humble. He says, I am not worthy of this post. He starts thinking to himself. He says, there was one classmate I had many years ago. His name is Sa'id al-Ulama al-Mazandarani. And he wrote a letter to Sa'id al-Ulama Mazandarani, who was in Iran at that time, in Mazandaran. He wrote to him a letter and he said, look, I remember when we were classmates, you are much cleverer than me. Now the time has come where we need a marja, taqleed for the ummah. So I request that you be the marja because you are more learned, more capable, more clever. And he sends the letter. The reply comes from Sa'id al-Ulama al-Mazandarani, says that, yes, it is true that when we were in class, I was cleverer than you. And I knew more than you. But I have been away from studies for so long. I cannot be marja taqleed. You have to be marja. When he received this letter, he started crying. Sheikh al-Ansari started crying. And the khadim of the haram of Amir al-Mu'mineen relates that I came in the morning to open for Fajr prayers the haram of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And as I opened the doors, I heard weeping and wailing near the dhariq. Somebody was crying so much and weeping. And when I turned on the light, I saw it was Sheikh al-Ansari. He was saying, oh Amir al-Mu'mineen, I have been given this task. I find it is such a difficult task. Please pray to Allah Azza wa Jal that I have the ability to fulfill this duty. This is the humbleness of our ulama, of our maraja. Inshallah, we will continue from tomorrow. Again, inshallah, Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka anta as-sami'u al-alim wa tub alayna innaka anta at-tawwab ar-rahim bi rahmatika ya arhamar rahimin.
Allahu akbar, la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu akbar. Allahu akbar. Allahu akbar.
Aperture.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions there. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917 when mustard gas is used for the first time and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of a present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defeo revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. We find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSci.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania, and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables, and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thioglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic, so our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishes are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you load in there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. But that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s, of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones.